You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with Gregor Chisholm for the Blue Jays podcast. Gregor, our MLB.com Blue Jays reporter. The Blue Jays, one of the few teams making news this week, so we have some stuff to talk about, Gregor. We'll also talk about the Hall of Fame and former Blue Jays on the ballot. Top 10 prospects list for catchers is out. The Blue Jays have a player on that as well. But let's start with Curtis Granderson, who is now a Blue Jay, although not officially, I think, as we record this podcast. What does he have left, right? Is that the biggest question here? He hit .212, 26 homers, so he still has some power. 70 RBIs in 2017. That was with the Mets and obviously the Dodgers late in the year. But the Blue Jays, it's one of those, they're not really throwing a lot in here, and maybe they catch lightning in a bottle, right?
Yeah, that is kind of the mentality a little bit. And to a certain extent, it's following the blueprint that they set aside for the infield. We saw them take care of that first with Olemus Diaz and Yonder Solarte, and they were kind of role players, I guess, to a certain extent around the infield, and now they're taking a somewhat similar approach to the outfield. And one thing they do like about Granderson is, you know, despite the advanced age, he still offers quite a bit of versatility in the outfield. So the Jays could look to move him around a little bit there as well. But the other part that they're really zeroing in on is starting him against right-handed pitching. And that's where his numbers last year did hold up pretty well. Obviously, there is that pretty big tail off with the Dodgers late in the year, and that's what the Blue Jays have to be concerned about. And as you touched on, how much is actually left in the tank. But the Jays are basically looking at his splits, career splits, and then also the splits from last year. I mean, it's a guy that they can platoon in theory with Steve Pierce, who can play against lefties, and then Granderson gives them another option against right-handers. Now the question is whether or not the Blue Jays are going to be able to add another piece around him, another significant bat to really improve that lineup. This provides a bit of an upgrade, but probably not as big of a one as Blue Jays fans have been hoping for.
He's been in the National League for a few years, but obviously a long history with the Yankees and Tigers in the American League before he moved over to the senior circuit. Certainly something interesting. He's a great clubhouse guy as well. Handles himself tremendously around the media, does a lot in the community generally as well. So a good guy to have, if nothing else. Another story that came up, J.P. Morosi, I think, right now has a story on MLB.com about this. But Marco Estrada obviously hit those struggles midseason last year, started the year on a typical Marco Estrada pace, finished the year well, and he's saying that he wasn't sleeping well in the middle of the season. Stress, some concerns about the trade deadline, but he seems to have worked all that out or worked it out during the year. But it was interesting to hear after the fact he's now kind of come out and talked about this a little bit, what the issues were.
Yeah, he's been a little bit more forthcoming now, and it's something he talked about towards the tail end of the season as well when he signed that one-year extension for the Blue Jays. Obviously, one of the things reporters went back on was his 2017 season and why there were some of those struggles. And what he talked about then was that, he didn't feel like it had anything to do with stuff that was going on the field. He admitted to having some personal issues away from the field. And then the latest interview, he's talking about how he just started sleeping better. And so I think the two of those are pretty tightly connected to one another. And then certainly the other factor that came into play was the trade deadline. And I mean, Marco Estrada is clearly someone who has established a pretty big level of comfort with the Blue Jays and in the city of Toronto. And I think he was really kind of rattled by, all the speculation mid-season last year. Now, the downside to that is he better hope that he's learned how to deal with that, because there's no guarantee it's not going to happen again in 2018. I mean, that's what happens when you're going year to year, which is he's doing right now on that one-year extension. There's a possibility that those rumors are going to pop up again, and certainly he hopes that's not the case, and the Blue Jays hope that's not the case, because that means they won't be in contention and they want to do bigger things than that. But it's not necessarily going to go away. So it's going to be one of those live and learn situations for Estrada. Even as a veteran guy, it just shows that some of those veteran guys still do need to go through some of those learning phases off the field as well.
All right, the top 10 catching prospects list is out on MLB Pipeline. The right-handers came out on Tuesday. Top 10 left-handers came out on Wednesday. Catchers today, as we record this, on Thursday. They'll go through the rest of the fielding positions, and then the top 100 prospects comes out on January 27th. But for the catchers, the Blue Jays check in with Danny Jansen, number 8. When you look at the list overall, Gregor, a lot of these guys are far away from the big leagues, and then there's some guys who have made their big league debuts. Jansen's interesting because he could certainly be a factor in 2018. Did you expect him to make this list?
Yeah, I did after the year he had in 2017. I mean, he's a guy that Jays have been talking him up internally now for, I mean, really since 2014 is when he first went on their radar. But in terms of across the league attention and certainly breaking into the rankings, it was the season he had in 2017. And, you know, part of that was his ability to stay healthy for the first time in 3 years. That's obviously first and foremost. There were a few things, kind of away from the field that he adjusted as well. One was as simple as getting fitted for glasses, getting prescribed glasses, and that really helped improve things in the batter's box as well for him as well. So, you know, in 2017, we really saw a breakout in power for him. It was the first time he reached double digits in home runs, and he's not going to necessarily be that high home run guy, but he's a guy who needs to have a decent amount of gap power in order to be successful. And so it really was a breakthrough season. He's kind of established himself now as the favorite to be the catcher of the future. And in terms of 2018, right now, he's competing to be number three on that depth chart. I mean, Russell Martin and Luke Maley are going to be on the big league roster. We know that. But right now, the only other two catchers are on the 40-man roster are Jansen and Reese McGuire. And so Jansen has an opportunity in spring training to come in and establish himself as that number three guy, so that if and when Martin or Maley goes down with an injury, he's going to be right there to step up and potentially make his big league debut.
It's interesting because McGuire is a guy that used to be on these lists, really highly thought of, and his star has faded a little bit, whereas Jansen has clearly come on in the last couple of years. All right, I want to talk a little bit about the Hall of Fame ballot, the Blue Jays with some candidates, some better than others, I guess, as far as their chances. But Roger Clemens is obviously a guy that had a Hall of Fame career. It's just a question of whether or not the voters decide that they can put the fact in the PEDs and all of that stuff behind him. Sixth year on the ballot right now out of 10. He's at 65.6% with 45.3% of the ballots in. That's the latest numbers I have as they collect these and put them up on the internet. That number will likely drop probably into the high 50s if we can go by past years, but he is trending in the right direction. He only pitched a couple of years in Toronto, Gregor, but 97 and 98 were unbelievable. 41 and 13, a 2.33 ERA, two All-Star games, two Cy Young Awards. And I was looking at all of his career stats. You could argue 1997 was the best year of his career, 21-7 and 2.05 ERA, and he threw 264 innings. When Blue Jays fans look at Roger Clemens, kind of where, how do they think of him? Because obviously he was a Red Sox for a long time, he was a Yankee, he was an Astro. He had those 2 years in Toronto, but they were special.
No, they really were. And he's not remembered fondly, mostly because of the way he exited.
Just like Boston, I think.
and the fact that he had asked for a trade away. But, I mean, the fact is, what you touched on is exactly true. I mean, you're talking about not only arguably his best season of his career, you're talking about arguably, the greatest single season pitching performance in Blue Jays history. And Toronto fans certainly remember that well. And, there's no doubt that he became a bit of a controversial figure. But when you look at the performance that he had in those two back-to-back years for the Blue Jays, I mean, it came at a time when the back-to-back World Series were still fresh in the minds of Blue Jays fans and they were trying to get back there. That was a big major splash in the free agent market that the Blue Jays did with then GM Gord Ash and really put together two of the best. I mean, you think about Roy Halladay, you think about Dave Steeb as the top pitchers in franchise history. But if you want to break it down to a season or two, no one had as good of a run as Roger Clemens did in Toronto.
So an unbelievable run for him. Fred McGriff is another guy. First five seasons of his career in Toronto. Sixth in the MVP vote in 1989. McGriff's a guy that gets a lot of discussion as a guy who's kind of not appreciated as much as he should be. How is he appreciated in Toronto?
He's definitely appreciated in Toronto. There's no question about that. I mean, you look at 5 years and you think, okay, that's not that much. But, I still think a lot of people think of him as a Blue Jay. And I think one of the reasons why they think that is just because they followed his development through the Blue Jay system and then breaking in with those 5 years that he had with the team. Obviously, he's remembered a little bit more for his inclusion in the blockbuster deal along with Tony Fernandez for Roberto Alomar and Joe Carter. But McGriff was really an underappreciated slugger. I think the Jays fans saw him early, and so that we have a different appreciation up here than maybe some did down there. But it took a little bit of time for him to get the recognition that he really deserved. And when you think about the era that he played in and some of the accusations that have been made about some of the players from that time, I mean, Fred McGriff really garnered a reputation as being a guy who played clean, who played it the right way. And that historical context, when you think about it that way, his numbers probably hold up a little bit more than maybe they even do on the surface. And so, it's going to be a challenge for him to get in. Obviously, there's no question about that. But he's rightfully in the mix because, it's nice to see him after such a long career and so productive as he was for a number of teams, to see how his numbers actually have held up over time.
Yeah, 86-90 with the Blue Jays, and then, of course, traded away, and then they win the World Series in 91 and 92. So tough timing on him, although because of that trade, he's obviously an integral part of those World Series titles in a different kind of way. Other guys that played for the Blue Jays, although they're not in any way thought of as Blue Jays, Omar Vizquel played 60 games as a 45-year-old with the Blue Jays. Scott Rolen played in 08 and 09 with the Blue Jays. And Jeff Kent made his major league debut with the Blue Jays. I didn't even know that until I started looking around here, Gregor. He was 24 years old back in 1992. He played 65 games, got his first big league hit, his first homer. So lots of players on this ballot with Blue Jays ties, although Clemens and McGriff, I think, the two biggest conversation points for sure. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Blue Jays edition. For Gregor Chisholm, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with Brittany Giroli, as usual, our MLB.com Orioles reporter. And I just said before we started, Brittany, I'm not talking about Manny Machado on this podcast, so that's the only time you're going to hear his name. I know people still have questions, but the fact of the matter is there's no new news, so we're going to move on from that for this week in the podcast. I'm sure we'll get back to it at some point. As for this team, it still needs pitching, obviously, and eventually the Orioles are going to get pitching. We don't know when that's going to be, but a lot of teams are currently in need of something and still waiting for it. As you look at this team right now, the organization still in the need for pitching, are they any closer from what you hear?
No, not really. I mean, look, they've made some deals, but either the pitcher didn't want to go there, or I know there's been some cases where the medicals have been a little tricky. Some of that has started to trickle out. I mean, they have made some effort, and part of it, of course, is the fact that the whole market has moved really slow. That hasn't helped. The other part of it is trying to convince good free agent pitchers to pitch at hitter-friendly Camden Yards in the American League East. I mean, it's a tall task. The Orioles don't figure to be in any of those top names. They're not going to offer more than 3 years to any of these guys, so it takes them out of the running of a lot of these top pitchers, so to speak. But certainly they still need some significant improvements. They can't just go out there and try to sign a bunch of guys and hope that they have bounce back here. So there hasn't been a whole lot of, I would say, like real solid progress. But certainly they're among many teams who still need to get that in gear before spring training, which is less than a month away.
I know there was a question in your last mailbag on MLB.com about Chris Davis and his need to bounce back, obviously, 2 years into this long contract. As far as that contract goes, obviously it was a situation where the team was at the time. They really wanted to keep him so they can continue to contend. Plus, he was a fan favorite as well. In the time since then, I'm not sure if he's as big a fan favorite. I think the fans still like him, but they're not pleased with the production the last couple of years. How much of a factor on what the team can do right now with contracts, signing people, looking to the future, is that contract really hamstringing them, or was that all part of the plan and they still have what they need to go forward?
It's hamstringing them to some degree. I mean, this was a record deal for the organization. So certainly it plays a part in what they can do. I don't know if they hadn't signed him, if they would even still have a chance at Manny Machado. I know people have asked that. And, I don't know. They have spent that money somewhere else. They came really close to signing Nelson Cruz and Nick Markakis. And, there are deals that they didn't make that also would have probably gotten in the way, so to speak, of the kind of money that Manny Machado would require. I think the bottom line is, if you're going to go all in on a player like Manny Machado, if you're the Orioles, it's at what cost? They wouldn't be able to sign anybody else around him. So then all of a sudden you kind of become Stanton with the Marlins, and it's great you've got one terrific player, but if you don't have anything else surrounding it, I mean, that gets ugly really fast. And I don't think people really understand that. But certainly the Davis deal. They'll be paying him for a very long time. He makes a lot of money. Of course, that has something to do with what they are or are not able to do when it comes to free agency. But I don't know if Davis's deal was big enough or you know, with Manny, how much money he's going to take. I don't know if those two would cancel each other out, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a good point, and we will see. You would hope that the first few years of the Davis deal would have been the best years, and then maybe he declines, but maybe they'll luck out in the sense that he'll finish that contract strong or at least get strong over the next couple of years and make that money have some more value. Well, the MLB Pipeline Gang is coming out with their top 10 prospects per position this week, all leading up to January 27th when the top 100 prospects will be revealed. So far this week, as we record this podcast, they've gone through right-handed pitchers, left-handed pitchers, and catchers. And the Orioles check in on the catching list. Chance Sisko coming in at number 7. He's a guy that obviously, when you look at the list of catchers, some of them have made it to the big leagues, some of them have not. He's one of the guys that has a chance to really be a factor in 2018. Is that about where you thought he would kind of check in when you look at the landscape of catching prospects?
I mean, yeah, I had hoped that he would be in that top 10. I think it's encouraging that, you know, he's the highest ranked in the division. You know, he's ahead of the Blue Jays. He's the only other one that's on there. But I think when you look at it, offensively, the Orioles have never really questioned what he would be able to do. I think the real question is going to be defense, and that's really probably going to be ultimately what decides whether he makes the club out of opening day or he goes back to AAA for more seasoning. But I think they really liked what they saw of him in that September call-up. I mean, he hit .333. It was only 22 plate appearances, but he performed well at AAA, you know, went to the All-Star Futures game for a second straight year. He's certainly taken the steps forward that they need. Just defensively, he has to get better at throwing out base stealers. I think he threw out 21 of 93 down at AAA and was 0-for-5 in the majors, and that's really going to be kind of the next step of his development is can he hold his own defensively, because we talked about how the Orioles need pitching. Well, they also need a guy behind the plate who's going to help them. And Chance Sisko has a chance to be that guy. He's just not that guy yet. So, yes, I was expecting to see him in that top 10. I think he's a guy who has a whole lot of upside. May end up passing some of those guys that he's currently behind, but certainly has a ways to go, I think, before you can kind of cement him in as their long-term catching option.
Yeah, and people that look at the list, it's obviously not all guys like Sisko who have a chance to be in the majors in 2018. Some of these guys are years away, and they are prospects, so who knows, 5 years from now you could look back and this top 10 could look completely different as far as where they all panned out. You mentioned the throwing being a struggle for him. How about the other parts of being a defensive catcher, blocking, framing, that kind of stuff? Does he do okay with that?
He does okay with that. I think he needs to get a little bit better at framing. They'd like for him to get better really in all aspects defensively. I know the throwing up base stealers is kind of the easiest stat to show people that he needs to improve, but he has kind of made some strides. And I think the important thing is that he's only been a catcher for 5 years. So he has still a big window to progress, to get even close to matching his talent potential. So that in and of itself should also kind of lend to a little optimism that, you know, he hasn't been catching his entire career. He's fairly new to this still. I think he's going to end up getting much better.
The Hall of Fame voting will be announced on Wednesday, and for a number of years now, the Orioles have had a guy to kind of pull for in that voting. Mike Mussina trying to make his way to Cooperstown, and he's a guy that's one of the more interesting cases and really has been, but he is slowly and kind of consistently gained some ground to the point where right now he's sitting at 72.8% in the votes that have been collected. We get this year. Nowadays, you hear the votes get announced, published, whatever, and they're tracked on the internet, which is wonderful for all of us because we can really debate this. But about half the votes have been tabulated, and he's at 72.8%. Usually that percentage will drop. You need 75% to get in. So chances are this will not be the season for Mike Mussina, but he's certainly trending in the right direction. And I was looking at his numbers, Brittany, 270 and 153 with a 3.68 ERA, 147 of those wins with the Orioles, 10 of his 18 years, obviously, with Baltimore before he went to the Yankees. But then I looked at Jack Morris's numbers. Obviously, Morris just got in via the Veterans Committee. Morris 254 and 186 with a 3.90 ERA. Both guys pitched a lot in the postseason. Obviously, Morris has those superior World Series moments. But I feel like we've gotten at the point now where if Jack Morris is a Hall of Famer, Mike Mussina has to be.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, I'm glad you said he's trending up because he has. He's gone up a little bit every year, you know, since he's been on that ballot, especially the last 4 years. But I think he's a guy who's really underrated because he doesn't have any World Series rings. He didn't win the Cy Young, even though he received votes in half of his 18 seasons. So, you know, he was a guy who was a consistent Gold Glover, a consistent All-Star. I think if you look really closely at his stats and you wonder, why wasn't he? You know, why wasn't he a bigger deal? And hopefully this year really kind of springboards so that maybe next year he can get in. But he's the Orioles. He's already in the Orioles Hall of Fame. He's their all-time leader in a lot of different pitching categories. You look at what he was able to do in an era where, you know, a lot of guys were steroids guys. And you know, there was a lot of who's cheating, who's not cheating. And, you know, Mike Mussina was able to be really, really effective for the Orioles. And I think it kind of gets overshadowed because he doesn't have those moments of glory, like you said, like a Jack Morris, some of these other guys. He wasn't a showy guy. He was a very keep-to-himself kind of guy. I think he was kind of understated, and that's almost hurting him now amongst the voters. In my opinion, he should probably already be in.
He's also a guy that he won 20 games in his final season with the Yankees, and a lot of people thought he obviously had something left. You wonder if he could have just played a couple more years. Those Yankees teams were pretty good at scoring runs. If he could have somehow gotten to 300 victories, you would think he would have been a lock at that point. But obviously that could have been two, three more years. But he was done in his mind, and he went out with a 20-win season, which is impressive. So Mussina, we will see. This won't be the year probably, but he's certainly heading in the right direction. Curt Schilling spent three seasons in Baltimore at the beginning of his career. He wasn't particularly effective with the Orioles, but he's another guy trending in the right direction. And then I was looking down the lineup, and Sammy Sosa briefly played with the Orioles. Jim Thome also, his final 28 games with Baltimore. So if you're clinging for hopes for Cooperstown and a connection to the Orioles, Jim Thome, who is headed this summer to Cooperstown more than likely, did finish things up. His last three homers, last 10 RBIs were with the Orioles. All right, great stuff. Thank you, Brittany, as always.
All right, thanks, Tim.
This has been MLB.com Extras, our Orioles edition. For Brittany Giroli, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here with the Yankees podcast. Brian Hoke, our MLB.com Yankees reporter, along for the ride. And we have a lot to talk about, believe it or not, Brian. I know you were thinking when we called you up, no news, but there's plenty to talk about with the Yankees. We're going to get into the Hall of Fame ballot and some former Yankees that are very much some of the more interesting cases there. The top 10 prospect lists are coming out starting this week from MLB Pipeline, and we can talk about a Yankee that's on one of the early lists that has come out. We'll also talk about a bullpen that could be tremendous in the Bronx this summer. But first, Gerrit Cole, who is not a Yankee. Instead, he has gone to the Houston Astros, which is bad news for the Yankees when you think ahead to the possible matchup in the postseason if all things go well. But we were talking about this a little, Brian, before we started. I want to get your take because I've talked to Yankees fans who were actually happy that the team didn't get Cole, because I think a lot of Yankees fans just love all these prospects and just want to hang on to them.
I could definitely see that. I think that Yankee fans have definitely fallen in love with the youth movement that's going on in the Bronx, and that's something that's going to continue into this year. And from what I understand, the talks with the Pirates came down to the Yankees were going to have to give up Clint Frazier and Miguel Andujar, the third base prospect, if they wanted to seriously be in play for Cole. And, you know, we can go back and forth and debate the return that Houston wound up getting. And you look at Cole's numbers, the Astros think he pitched into some bad luck last year. They think he's going to bounce back a little bit, joining the World Champions, of course. But I think the Yankees were right to not give up Frazier and Andujar for Cole. I think that they're pivoting to do something else there. But, you know, Frazier's blocked in the outfield. I could see why Brian Cashman would want to dangle him as a trade chip. But if the season started today, Miguel Andujar would be your starting third baseman. So, certainly somebody that the bat, they believe, is big league ready already. The defense is getting there. It's something he's still improving. But they think sooner rather than later, this guy is going to be in the Bronx. So I definitely understand why the Yankees did not want to give him up.
Yeah, absolutely. And interesting you said that, that something could still happen. And when you look at the package that the Astros did get, I would say it falls short of Frazier and Andujar. A little more quantity, but not as much quality. They did give up a ready-to-go big league pitcher in Joe Musgrove, but I think no one really knows what Joe Musgrove is just yet. Colin Moran is a highly thought-of prospect, but it's been a slow road for him to get to the big league. So I think the Yankees kind of standing pat where they did was a good move, and instead of jumping to that. As far as Andujar goes, the top 10 prospect lists are coming out. I don't want to give too much away because third baseman isn't out yet, but you can expect Andujar to check in on one of those infield lists from MLB Pipeline. But one guy that has already come out is the left-handed pitching list, which came out on Wednesday. Justice Sheffield is number three. Another guy that Yankees fans are very high, or Yankees as an organization are very high on. How close is Justice Sheffield?
I think he's somebody you can dream on. You know, this is somebody who missed 2 months of the season last year at AA, but was able to bounce back and pitch in the Arizona Fall League. He made 5 starts out there, pitched pretty well. And, you know, Yankee fans are going to really like this guy when they see him this spring. Yeah, he should be in big league camp. I'm sure he's going to get into some games, but you're looking at a left-hander who throws the ball 98 miles an hour. You know, there's been some talk about should he be a starter or a reliever. I think that that remains to be seen. But, you know, the folks at Pipeline see him as a number two or number three starter in a big league rotation. And so this is somebody you can be legitimately excited about. I don't think he's going to make the opening day roster out of camp. That would be a pretty big jump to not have pitched a AAA. But he's certainly somebody who I think could be in play this season, and you might see him make his major league debut. So we'll see how Sheffield does in the spring. He can open some eyes with the new coaching staff. They'll get a look at him up close and personal. And then I would think he'll be on the short list of guys who could get called up for a spot start or maybe help out in the bullpen.
So far, right-handed pitchers came out Tuesday, lefties on Wednesday, catchers came out on Thursday, which is today as we record the podcast. Then it'll go around the infield and onto the outfield, and Yankees fans can expect to see some more prospects from the organization to make those top 10 lists for sure. Mike Petriello has a story out this week about the Yankees bullpen and, Brian, the possibility of it being ready. The best bullpen of all time. And I don't even know what that means. And Mike Petriello admits in the article that neither does he really. But he uses a lot of numbers. Obviously, he's one of our big StatCast guys here at MLB.com. But one of the points he makes is that when you look at the bullpen in 2017, it ranked as far as FIP goes, fielding independent pitching, fourth all time behind the 2003 Dodgers, 1964 Reds, and the 2017 Indians as well. But that takes into effect the fact that David Robertson didn't join the team till late in the season. Same with Canely. So you're looking at a bullpen that was very good last year, and they expect in 2018 to have a full season of some of the guys that made it so good late last year. So when you think about it that way and you look at the names with Chapman and Betances and Robertson and Canely and Green, Warren, Shreve, the depth is amazing too. How do you see this bullpen?
Well, here's my smart aleck comment. How can they have the best bullpen of all time without Mariano Rivera in it? So that was my first thought. But I think that the Yankee bullpen is going to be excellent. You know, CeCe Sabathia was talking recently, and he said that the same as last year, you go into 2018 thinking you really just got to give 6-7 innings and then hand it over to the bullpen because they are so good and so deep back there. You expect that Chapman and Betances can straighten out the mechanical issues they had. You know, Chapman fell out of the closer's role for a little bit last year, so it wasn't smooth sailing the entire season. Chad Green was fantastic. Can he replicate that? David Robertson was very good after coming over. As you mentioned, Tommy Canley, I think, can do a lot more this year. I think that he impressed for sure, especially in the postseason. I think he can build off that. So they definitely do have a deep crop of guys in that bullpen. They should be able to lock down leads. And, you know, with the offense they've got, when you're talking about Stanton and Judge and Sanchez in the heart of that lineup, I do think there's going to be a lot of 2-, 3-, and 4-run leads for these guys to protect. So it's definitely going to be a big part of the team. You know, the Yankees want to add another starting pitcher, but the bullpen might be their greatest strength, and that's saying something because of the lineup that they have.
In 2017, they had the third lowest ERA in the big leagues, lowest average against by other teams, highest strikeout rate, and the biggest WAR at 9.2. And he makes the point that if you had put together all those players that are currently in the bullpen, if you put their whole seasons together for 2017, that FIP number jumps up to 40, and the highest ever is 32. So a lot of interesting points in there. It's a fun article to read just to kind of dream on this bullpen. But, of course, bullpens, Brian, are just so unpredictable from year to year. These guys seem to be dependable, but then you look at Dellin Betances last year and how undependable he became at points, and you never know.
Absolutely not. Yeah, it's a guessing game from year to year with bullpens, and it fluctuates so much. So that's, you see general managers scratch their heads so much because you give a big contract to a guy who is lights out, and then he's just not that guy the next year. So the Yankees really do have to hope. On the other hand, they can hope that Betances is not the guy that he was last year, particularly in the second half. You know, when you're 6'8", your mechanics get out of whack, and that's really what happened with him. He was unable to control his fastball, so he became so reliant on the breaking ball. And when you can't throw your fastball for strikes, it's really hard to succeed at the big league level. So that's something that Dellin Betances has worked on this offseason. He went back down to the Dominican Republic. He was working out on that. And we're going to watch that closely in the spring to see if his walk rate is still as high as it was in the second half last year because, as I said, it's really tough to get outs when you're not throwing the ball over the plate.
It sure is. All right, let's talk about the Hall of Fame ballot a little bit. And a couple of former Yankees are very much in the discussion, as they have been really for a number of years. One guy who's getting really close is Mike Mussina. He's currently, as the votes are slowly tabulated and collected on the internet, 72.8% of the ballots have Mike Mussina right now, with 46% reporting. So that number generally is going to come down a little bit. So it doesn't look like Mussina is going to get in here in 2018, but he's certainly trending in the right direction. And this is my thought, Brian. When you look at Mussina, there was an argument for him, obviously, in the past years. There's a lot of interesting numbers. The win total, obviously, is huge. The ERA isn't great. He was 270 and 153, a 3.68 ERA, 8 of his 10 seasons with the Yankees. But once Jack Morris got into the Hall of Fame, thanks to the Veterans Committee last month at the winter meetings, you look at Mussina's numbers and Morris's numbers. Mussina, 270, 153 with a 3.68 ERA. Morris, 254 and 186 with a 3.90 ERA. I just feel like if Jack Morris is in the Hall of Fame, Mike Mussina has to be there with him.
I thought that even before Jack Morris got in. I thought that Mike Mussina should be a Hall of Famer. I don't have a vote yet, but if I did, I would definitely put him on my ballot. And I think here's the best argument I can give for Mussina. Yes, he has 270 wins. And that's fantastic, but he pitched his entire career in the American League East with Baltimore and New York during a time when, let's be honest, steroids were impacting the game. He was a winning pitcher. He was able to shut down those massive, overloaded lineups, consistent winner year after year, finished his career as the oldest first-time 20-game winner, walked off in 2008 and got that done finally, almost pitched a perfect game, you know, all this stuff. He was in the Cy Young voting. He just happened to pitch at the same time that Pedro Martinez was in Boston, so he got overshadowed. But, yeah, Mike Mussina is a Hall of Famer in my book, and I think that sooner, at some point, it may not be this year, but certainly now that Jack Morris, you can make those statistical comparisons. But Mike Mussina's career in the AL East, I think that longevity, numbers, he's got what it takes to be in Cooperstown, and he should be there.
It's his fifth year on the ballot, so five more years after this, you would think he was definitely going to find his way in at some point now, and I think he's getting a little boost from the Jack Morris vote as well. Things against him, I guess, he was only an All-Star five times. Those all came with the Orioles, none of them with the Yankees, and of course the ERA not great, but you mentioned a lot of the reasons for that are those lineups that he was facing, and he was still able to beat those lineups. So he's one interesting case, and then of course there is Roger Clemens, who's in his sixth year on the ballot, also trending in the right direction right now. He's up to 65.6% with that same percentage of ballots in. Now, he is likely to take a bigger hit before the final votes are tallied just because of the people that are holding out. Oftentimes with him and Bonds, don't have him on the ballot. So he will likely drop a little bit from there, maybe into the high 50s. But still, 4 years left on the ballot. We'll see. He's certainly heading in the right direction. But the interesting case of Clemens is nobody will ever argue that he didn't have a Hall of Fame career.
No, of course not. Yeah, obviously it's the performance-enhancing drug use or suspicion thereof that we're talking about, Mitchell Report, all that. I mean, chapter and verse, we don't have to go over it again. But I think what you're seeing is there's a younger crop of voters who are coming in, and that's why you keep seeing Clemens gain in percentage every year. There's a group that's more forgiving. You know, it's a generation that grew up in the 1980s and 1990s watching this guy dominate. Seven-time Cy Young Award winner, 354 wins, you know, just off the top of my head. This guy was great, you know, with Boston, with Houston, with New York, with Toronto. He would go out there, and he was definitely a competitor. I remember the day at Yankee Stadium in 2007 when they stopped the game and announced that he was coming back in mid-game, and he would come back and help the Yankees make the playoffs in 2007. It turned out to be the end of his major league career. But, you know, what a career. And obviously, there is a cloud over him and guys like Barry Bonds. But if you're looking at the numbers and only the numbers, I don't think there's any argument that those guys don't deserve to be in Cooperstown. I think that as time goes on here, that's getting relaxed a little bit. And, you know, Joe Morgan said what he said, and I think there's a debate to be had on both sides. But it certainly does seem to be trending in the direction that one or both those guys are going to get 75% of the ballot and go into the Hall of Fame before their time is up.
And Clemens and Bonds currently exactly the same percentage, although oddly not necessarily on all the same ballots. Some of them differ. Some people actually have Clemens or Bonds on a ballot and not the other one. I have no idea. I can't figure out the Hall of Fame voting, but it is what it is. The other former Yankee on the ballot, Andrew Jones, who didn't play long with the Yankees but briefly was in there, he's going to struggle to stay on the ballot. He's right at 6.2% right now. You have to stay above 5%. So we'll hopefully get Andrew Jones enough. He'll get up enough there to at least stay on the ballot for a little bit longer so people can continue to look at his career. All right, that's going to do it. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Yankees edition. For Brian Hoke, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, and stepping in for Bill Chastain on the podcast this week, Dwayne Statz, broadcaster for the Rays. We always love to have Dwayne along for the ride. We're going to talk about some fun stuff, Hall of Famers, Hall of Fame ballot players, I guess I should say, that played for the Rays. We'll also talk about some of the young, exciting players coming up through the Rays system. But, Dwayne, since you haven't been on this podcast for a while, I wanted to start with just getting your overall thoughts of this team right now, because it's obviously been an interesting offseason so far. The trade of Evan Longoria, kind of the big highlight, because it brings into question the direction now of this team and are they rebuilding? Obviously, there are other possible trades that could be made. But what was your first reaction as a guy who's obviously broadcast so many of Evan Longoria's games? Had to make you a little bit sad to see him traded away, right?
Yeah, Tim, I think you're absolutely right about that. You know, Evan Longoria will be missed here on a number of fronts. You know, not only what he did at third base and the bat in the middle of that lineup. He's a guy who wanted to play every day and has been active. You know, he's not a guy who calls a lot of attention to himself, but he was active in the community, did a lot of great things there. So there's no question he's going to be missed, and what it does, it sets up, I think, a lot of questions about where this team is headed and what the approach will be. I think the immediate assumption is that it's going to be a complete tear down and rebuild. Ownership has said that's not the case, that they want to still be a factor in the American League East. That's always a challenge. It has been from day one here all the way back to 98. And Evan, of course, made a big difference when he arrived 10 years later, and for almost 10 years then was just a constant in this lineup. It will be interesting. I think, you know, the East is always very difficult. I think one of the things that this club still feels, they have some pitching depth in the organization, and I think it begins there. You think if you have good pitching, then you can be competitive day in and day out, especially if you can figure out how to protect it with good defense, protect that pitching with defense. I don't think they're finished making some moves and additions, and it's going to be an interesting couple of months, you know, leading up to and into spring training and then the regular season.
We've seen some teams obviously tank in recent years with great success for what it's worth. Obviously, the Cubs, what they did, the Astros now winning a title. The Rays have managed to stay competitive without really ever doing that. And the impressive thing I would say right now, if they are rebuilding, is they already have a strong system, which they've been able to do without falling into last place and having super high draft picks. It's a compliment to the things they've been able to do. And I think it's a situation where if you do look at where they would rebuild right now a little bit, they won't have those lean years, I don't think, because the system is already good. So if you're just trying to get it a little bit better, it's not going to take too long to really turn things around.
Yeah, Kevin Cash told me last year, about the middle of the year, that he thought at the AAA level, they had four or five, six arms down there that could help this club this coming year. Honeywell is going to probably top that list. They also like Ryan Yarborough. He's a guy who hides the ball well in his delivery. So I think they do have some options there. And to go back to our idea that, you know, pitching really is the bedrock of any club, most of their position players, I think, were in the lower minor leagues. But they do have a couple who they feel would have a shot at making this club and contributing this coming year. And they do believe that in the lower minor leagues, they have a lot of talent, which lends itself to the idea that maybe in the Longoria trade, they got some young talent back. If they're not finished dealing, you know, there would be another arm or two that I'm sure they'll have some discussions about, maybe a position player, and try to further stockpile a lot of talent in their system. Because at the end of the day, they're going to have to develop out of their own system. They've attempted to do that and to make some deals to get young minor league players into their system to get them to the big leagues. That's going to be the stock and trade of this team, and then try to augment with serviceable major league players, impact to some point with some versatility. And so that has been, over the last few years, their approach here, and I think it will continue to be that.
Yeah, when you talk about position players kind of knocking on the door, Jake Bowers seems like he's about ready. Willie Adames is a guy that a lot of people love at shortstop as well, that they brought in a trade a couple of years ago. You mentioned Brent Honeywell, and over the course of this week, MLB Pipeline is putting out its top 10 list for each position as far as prospects go. Brent Honeywell checking in at number 4 for right-handed pitchers. Brendan McKay, who was just drafted last June, obviously number 5 for lefties. McKay's still a ways away, and he's a guy who can also hit, as a lot of people who follow college baseball and prospects know. He's a two-way kind of player who the Rays like a lot. But I wanted to focus a little bit on Honeywell. He's a guy that started the Futures game last year at the All-Star game, pitched 2 innings in that game, struck out 4. He's got a whole bunch of pitches. And it seems like if spring training goes well for him, depending on what happens, this is a guy who could find himself in the rotation, if not on opening day, Duane, pretty soon this season, if the door opens at all for him in that rotation.
Yeah, Brent Honeywell is a guy who's been interesting from the time they drafted him, and he is certainly not lacking in talent or the confidence to think that he can compete and be a winning pitcher. So I think there's a better than even chance that, depending on what they do, as you point out, with the potential trades, that Honeywell, sooner or later, obviously, is going to be a factor on this rotation. I think he'd prefer it to be sooner. McKay, you're right. Two-way guy, really the last successful guy to do that over a long period would have, I guess, been Babe Ruth. Been a couple of guys in between, and they're obviously high on him and looking at him as a two-way player. But in the immediate future, Honeywell is a guy who will be very interesting to watch and see how soon he gets up here.
His best pitch or his most famous pitch is a screwball as well, which I don't even know what that means really at this point. It's a pitch that I feel like people used to throw and it kind of went away. And now that's what they've given the name to his out pitch as far as off speed stuff goes. It has a whole lot of movement. And I was at the Futures game and he made a lot of people look silly with that screwball. It's a fascinating pitch that I think once he makes it to the big leagues, there's going to be a lot of attention on.
Yeah, I think he thrives on the attention, number one. I'm not sure that's going to be an issue for him, but he sort of welcomes that. And to see a guy with that kind of movement, you know, whether it's that screwball-like movement that goes down and into a right-handed hitter away from a lefty or breaks the other way, you know, I think most pitching coaches would tell you, if you can figure out a way to make a pitch move in two different directions, whatever you want to call it and whatever those pitches might be, if you can command pitches, one goes one way and one goes the other, you've got a chance to be successful at the big leagues, and you combine that with some velocity and a lot of confidence, and I think that's where Honeywell lives.
All right, let's move on to a little Hall of Fame talk, Duane. And obviously, you look at the list, there's no guys with the percentages coming out nowadays. We don't really have to wait until the announcement to know where things are headed, at least. Obviously, there's guys that are close. But you think of the ballot this year, as far as former Rays go, Fred McGriff. It's his ninth year on the ballot. He's currently at 17.7% as far as ballots that have already been recorded. Last year, he was at 21.7, so down a little bit, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. When you think of McGriff, he obviously played a long time for different teams, but he's a guy that's from Tampa, the Tampa Bay area, hit 99 homers with the Rays. So I think Rays fans do connect with Fred McGriff. Do you feel like he just, for whatever reason, maybe it's timing of when he's been on the ballot, he just hasn't gotten the appreciation that he should?
Well, I think a couple of things there. Number one, you know, he played on a lot of good teams, and he played on a lot of teams that had other great talent around him. And so he never was the one guy who carried a team. Although when you look at his numbers and home runs in particular, I think his Hall of Fame consideration is legitimate. I just think in some ways he was a victim of circumstance there. Finished his career here in a time when it was a fresh expansion team, so you're not going to get a lot of exposure that way either. But I'd love to see him do that. I think when you look at longevity and offensive production as to what he did, and he was on some pretty good teams as well, so I think you can make a solid case, and I'd like to see those numbers pick up a little bit for him, because it's not trending in the right direction right now.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they've gone from a 15-year stint on the ballot down to 10, so really after this year, he'll only have 1 year left, and then it'll be, I guess, the wait to the veteran. He'll be an interesting guy as far as veterans committees down the road, because I think his peers in the game probably hold him in a higher regard maybe than the current writers that are voting, so that may help him down the road. But it doesn't look like he'll be getting in the BBWAA way of getting into the Hall of Fame. The other two guys on the ballot that I think are interesting, they're not Rays by any means. People wouldn't consider them Rays. But back in 2011, Duane, Johnny Damon and Manny Ramirez spent some time in Tampa Bay uniforms. Manny played his final five games with the Rays. He had a hit and an RBI. Damon played a little more that season with the team. Damon, it's his first year on the ballot. Manny, it's his second. Did those guys liven things up in 2011 in their brief time with the Rays?
Well, they did, especially Damon. But, you know, Manny was almost a non-factor here, as you point out. It was very short-lived. But Damon, I think, you know, he couldn't help wherever he was to liven up a clubhouse and a dugout and a traveling party. That's part of who he was. And I know that he's a guy who played the game hard. And I think every player who plays for an extended period and have some success has to have that in the back, at least in the back of their minds, about if I can play long enough and put up enough numbers, I could get Hall of Fame consideration. And I think Johnny Damon felt that way. I think he tried to extend his career and pick up as many numbers and rack up some great totals there to get some consideration. And I think, obviously, if you based it on the spirit that he brought to a team, he'd be in there. I think it's going to be a challenge for him. And you always hate to say that because he was a guy who played the game hard, helped to sell the game, and brought a lot of excitement to a team. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with him and how much of a challenge it is for him.
Yeah, currently at 1.6% of the vote. So likely, unfortunately, for Johnny Damon fans, he could fall off the ballot after 1 year. All right, Duane, it's great having you on the podcast, as always. Thank you so much for stepping in for Bill Chastain and joining us.
Always a pleasure, Tim. Good to be with you.
This has been MLB.com Extras, our Rays edition. For Duane Stats, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Welcome into the podcast again. Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Red Sox reporter, Ian Brown. Ian, we're going to talk a little bit about the Hall of Fame ballot. A lot of former Red Sox on there. Some of them have been on there for a while. Some of them are new to the ballot this year. We'll talk a little bit about that. Win projections are out, the early win projections for 2018. And the Red Sox and Yankees check in at interesting positions, but I want to start with the same topic that we've been kind of starting with every week on the podcast. That is J.D. Martinez, who remains a free agent. The latest kind of information that's been leaked as far as J.D. goes is that the Red Sox offer that we talked about a little bit last week on the podcast, the numbers came through a little bit. Supposedly, this is obviously all reports and rumors, 5 years, $100 million. When you look at that number, Ian, obviously it makes sense that J.D. wouldn't take that. Here's a guy that's been asking for $30 million, and to get just $20 million for, I think, less years than he probably wants as well is probably a no-brainer. But I think you got to give some credit to the Red Sox here because obviously nobody else is topping that offer right now.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the Red Sox really want J.D. Martinez, but they want to be smart about it. And they want to bid on what's out there in the market and not just, you know, what J.D. Martinez and Scott Boras think that he's worth. And just like the market, like for J.D. Martinez, it hasn't really emerged. It hasn't really emerged for a lot of players right now. So they put that offer out there just to say, hey, we're very interested. You know, $100 million isn't exactly a small commitment. So they're waiting to see where this market goes. And, you know, maybe they'll come back with a better offer at a later time. But I think everybody's surprised just at the slow pace of just this entire winter, not just with J.D., but with, you know, free agents all around baseball. I think we're all antsy to start seeing some player signs so we can see how these teams are sort of shaping up heading into 2018.
And it has started to pick up a little bit over the last week or so. Trades and signings. Jay Bruce has now signed with the Mets and obviously the Garrett Cole trade, things like that. So things are moving a little bit, but a long way to go for sure. And J.D. Martinez has said that he's willing to take this into spring training. Now, saying that and actually doing it are two different things. That could be just a kind of a ploy to get people going because he's, you know, saying he's being patient. I think once players and pitchers and catchers start reporting to Florida and Arizona, I think the pressure maybe swings a little bit to the player at that point. Wouldn't you think if he's still out there, a free agent, and sees that everybody else is getting to work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this guy is sitting around doing his daily workouts every day. It's got to get monotonous after a while, and all his buddies are at camp getting ready for the season. Yeah, I don't see it. And it's not like, you know, if the worst that he does is has to sign for $100 million over 5 years, I mean, there's worse plights people have been in their life. So it's not like he doesn't have an offer. So I think that at some point something's got to give here. It's just been a staring contest for weeks now, and I'm really curious to see who's going to play first. And maybe at the end of the day, you know, I think that he signs for something like 5 years at $125 million, you know, something like that, $25 million a year. Maybe there's some sort of vesting option there. But let's just get on with it because this is kind of getting tiresome for all of us, just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen here.
Yeah, that's actually the exact number I was actually throwing around with some other people earlier today. Was 5 years, add another $5 million per year, and that would make a lot more sense as far as getting to what he's looking for. And still, I think if he came out at that point, people would say the Red Sox maybe got a bargain considering the market at this point. All right, moving away from J.D. Martinez, some of the evaluations are out basically on FanGraphs looking ahead to 2018. How many wins teams will come up with as far as projections go? These obviously change as more players are added to each team. But in the early projections, no surprise, the Astros check in at number one, 98 wins. Dodgers number two, 94 wins. So there's your World Series participants from 2017. The Indians, 93 wins. No surprise there. The Cubs, 92. And then the Red Sox, Yankees, and Nationals all come through at 91 wins. So tied for basically the fifth spot, which that seems to be a logical spot. I think a lot of people, because of Giancarlo Stanton and everything the Yankees have done here, would have said, oh, they're the favorites. But according to these numbers, and obviously FanGraphs numbers are based on a lot of different things, they actually have the Red Sox and Yankees in a dead heat. Kind of interesting, Ian, just seeing those numbers at this point in the offseason.
Yeah, it is interesting because, like you said, you know, a lot of people would look at the Yankees as clearly the favorites because, you know, last year the Red Sox won the division. I think it was by one or two games. And, you know, the Yankees added the best power hitter in the game. I think what it tells you is that people like some of these Red Sox hitters to have an uptick over what they did last year. They like this team with Rafael Devers in the lineup for a full season. They like this team with David Price in the rotation for a full season. So there's, you know, some things to look at here when it comes to the Red Sox. But, yeah, these numbers are a lot of fun. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, what these two teams do before camp to maybe, you know, upgrade their teams further, whether the Yankees are going to add another arm. They're talking to Yu Darvish, whether the Red Sox are finally going to get J.D. Martinez and where those probabilities would go from there.
Yeah, certainly a lot of things likely to change in those numbers between now and opening day. We will see and we'll see. But I would think both those teams, 90 wins is kind of that number where you're confident you get to that point. You're probably headed to the playoffs. So in that sense of things, it's a good number to be around for both Red Sox and the Yankees. All right, the Hall of Fame ballots have been out, obviously. The announcement coming out next Wednesday. It'll be live on MLB Network, MLB.com, as well as, I believe, Facebook this year. We'll be carrying the announcement live. Obviously, plenty of former Red Sox still on this ballot. Just wanted to go through them a little bit with you, Ian. Roger Clemens still there. Sixth year on the ballot now. It's also the sixth year for Curt Schilling. So two former Red Sox. Obviously, one that started his career and had so many great years before going elsewhere. And then you have Schilling, who obviously ended his career and had the bloody sock and the World Championship in 2004, all of that. Amazingly, they're both in the sixth year in the ballot out of 10. And as we record this podcast, with 45.3% of the ballots in, they are both at exactly 65.6% of the ballot. You can't make that stuff up, Ian. These two guys, they seem to be both trending in the right direction, although Schilling may be a little quicker than Clemens at this point.
Yeah, you know, let me start with Schilling because he's a little more of a clear-cut case with less variables to talk about because you're just judging him on his pitching and not some of the other things that are out there with Roger. But look, Schilling to me, very much like Jack Morris, who finally got into the Hall of Fame because he was not just a workhorse for his team for so many years, but also, you know, who would you rather have in a big game than Curt Schilling? But, you know, some of the numbers he put up are pretty impressive. And I think what happened was he got overshadowed a little bit, pitching with Randy Johnson, pitching with Pedro for that 1 year. And people don't realize just how dominant this guy was once he finally figured it out. Too bad he had some arm problems and some maturity problems earlier in his career. But this guy is a horse. And, you know, I know his win total is low at 216, but pretty much all of his other numbers, to me, are Hall of Fame worthy, and I think that he should be in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, Clemens, a no-brainer when you take out the performance-enhancing stuff, obviously, because even, you know, you just take his career up through, like, 96 when he left the Red Sox. He was probably, he had 192 wins at that point with three Cy Youngs and all those strikeouts. Probably a Hall of Famer at that point. Just a dominant career, and it's unfortunate that some of this other stuff kind of cast a cloud over his candidacy, so you don't know how that's going to work. And it's, you know, I would be of the mind to just say, look, the steroid guys, how are we going to know who actually did it and who didn't? Just do what people have talked about, put an asterisk next to guys who went in during that time and say they played in what was, you know, called the steroid era or whatever you want to call it. But these are the best of the best from that time, and I think that's the only way you're going to be able to do it. I know it's going to upset the current Hall of Famers who have been very vocal about not wanting anyone associated with PEDs in the Hall of Fame, but I just don't see how, you know, we're going to play judge and jury right now and decide that, oh, Manny Ramirez failed the test, so he's not in the Hall of Fame, but Roger Clemens might have done steroids, but he never tested positive, so maybe he is in the Hall of Fame. It's just too hard to do.
We are in complete agreement as far as that goes. If you look at the numbers from a year ago for Clemens, he finished at 54.1%. He did have a big drop-off when the final ballots kind of came out, which if you look into the numbers right now, it seems like he'll probably finish this year in the high 50s with four more years on the ballot. It makes you just wonder how many people will thaw on that issue as far as his getting in. Then on the Schilling side, because you don't have the PED shadow, he was at 45% last year, and currently at 65. You figure he'll drop a little bit as well. But that's going to be a decent climb with four more years on the ballot. I feel like Schilling is actually on a pretty good pace, and we will see. It's obviously going to come down to it. My thought, though, is if Jack Morris is in the Hall of Fame, Curt Schilling's a Hall of Famer. I mean, one way to look at it is to compare players. And if you're going to say Jack Morris is a Hall of Famer, I don't know how Curt Schilling isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Jack Morris had more longevity than Curt Schilling, but Curt Schilling at his best was a more dominant pitcher than Jack, and the numbers bear that out. So I think those two things offset each other a little bit, and I think they should both be Hall of Famers. I was a long proponent of Jack Morris, and I was glad to see him finally get in, and I thought from the jump that Curt Schilling was a Hall of Famer.
All right, and then other two guys that are on this list, Johnny Damon's in his first year on the ballot, and it looks like it'll be his last as he's at 1.6% right now. And Manny Ramirez on the ballot for the second time. He's at 24.5%, and I think the difference, I mean, if you look at them as players, Roger Clemens, clearly, if you take out the PEDs, an all-time great pitcher, no doubter. And Manny Ramirez, if you take out the PEDs, is an all-time great hitter and a no-doubt Hall of Famer. The problem is Manny got caught and seem to really be bothered by that to the point where he got caught again. That is going to be the thing. And it's hard to imagine him rising up from that 24.5%. Is that kind of how you see that, the fact that Manny was kind of a two-time offender and that's just not going to – there's no way to kind of win the voters over at that point?
Yeah, I mean, Manny's going to be penalized for his stupidity.
Well put.
He didn't try to mask the fact that he was cheating. He just, where some of these other guys might have found some masking agents or something, and maybe some of these guys are eventually going to get in because they didn't fail a test. That's why I think that this whole issue has been so cloudy. That's why I really like the idea of just finding the best of the best from this era, putting an asterisk next to it, saying this was a steroid era. Fortunately, that's over. We hope now. But like Manny was one of the best pure hitters I ever saw. Just covering him, I know that his numbers, maybe some of it came from PEDs, but not all. Look, this guy worked as hard as any player I've ever seen. I mean, he was at the park at 10 in the morning on a game day, studying film, swinging. This guy was tireless with his work ethic and wanting to be great. His technique was off the charts. And, as far as Johnny Damon goes, one of my all-time favorite guys to cover, joy to be around, but I think he made one or two All-Star teams, just not quite just in that next level down. He was a very consistent, solid player for a long time, but just not a Hall of Fame player.
Yeah, I agree. I would put Clemens in. I would put Manny in. I would put, obviously, Bonds in, all those guys. And I was on the fence as far as Schilling goes, and I've always said the last couple of years I'm biased because we work with Jack Morris here at MLB.com that I wanted him to be in. And once he got in, it kind of changed my opinion on Schilling, and I think he should probably be in there now as well. But I'm one of these guys who likes to see get those guys in there, because if you look at some of the Hall of Famers from years ago, there's some questionable guys. So let's get the questionable guys in there if we need to right now. All right, that is going to do it for MLB.com Extras, our Red Sox edition. For Ian Brown, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.